When you hear the phrase soft as steel, what do you think of? While the word steel might conjure up images such as massive high-rise buildings, where does the soft part come in? And what exactly does this mean in our work and in our lives? Welcome to the Soft as Steel podcast with your host, Dennis Duran, featuring engaging conversations with a wide range of industry leaders around soft skills, how we practice love, inclusion, social justice, and compassionate leadership that's everlasting in the workplace. And now, here's Dennis Duran.
Today's conversation is long overdue. My guest has an incredible story, and while it was the farthest from his mind at the time, he followed his father's footsteps into the sheet metal trades. Henry Nutt has traveled on a challenging, at times frustrating and troubling journey since he began his 36-year career in the construction industry. He has experienced firsthand being treated differently, being discriminated against. He nearly quit after about a year and a half in his apprenticeship. A couple of voices pulled Henry back, and he continued his apprenticeship. He worked sporadically for a number of years, and he reached another point in his journey and again made the decision to leave the trades and pursue another career path. He received a message while riding home on BART one evening that moved him and did not give up, and he returned to the trades. Henry has been a member of the sheet metal union since October 1987. In 2007, he became a sheet metal foreman with Southland Industries, a leading mechanical contractor. His career with Southland has been characterized by progressing to higher levels of responsibility in field operations. He has managed $1.5 billion in construction work during his tenure as general superintendent. And in 2019, he was named to the position of pre-construction executive. Henry is widely recognized as a serious thought leader in the construction industry and a strong advocate for diversity, equity, and inclusion. In 2022, Henry published the book entitled Seven Principles, Creating Your Success in the Construction Industry. The book is so relatable for the simple fact that Henry's own experiences inspired him to write this valuable how-to. There's something for everyone in the pages of this book to learn from. Henry, welcome to the Soft as Steel podcast.
Thank you, Dennis. That was an awesome introduction. And I can say that, you know, when you write your own introductions and you know what people are going to say, it's kind of like, okay, but obviously didn't tell you what to say. And I appreciate the introduction. It was very warm.
Well, good. Thank you for saying that. I guess I get to keep my job as podcast host for one more episode. I'm going to jump in right towards the end of my opening introduction. Because I think it's probably something I know that we kind of, I think we follow each other on LinkedIn. I know I see many of your postings. I imagine you see some of mine. Absolutely. And there's some folks that I've had on the podcast that I know you have friendships with. So you may have listened to their podcast as well. Yeah. And so you know where I'm coming from is I choose, because I think it's so incredibly important, I choose to talk about the people part of our business, which in a general sense is exactly what you did with your book. You're not talking about the technical aspects of being a trades worker. You're not talking about how to use project management software or how to do problem solving. You're talking about really, as I look through your seven principles, these are all principles that deal with different facets of how we are when we do what we do. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, there are so many great people in this industry that follow the path of dealing with the technical aspects, and I applaud them. We need it as necessary. However, my journey and my experiences and the opportunities I had as a superintendent to really work with people and individuals on projects, I found myself realizing that they needed more of that people development and really understanding who they are as human beings and how they show up at work and some of those issues that we all experience as humans, mothers and fathers and families. And that was a very important aspect that was missing. And so I can't say I went into it thinking that's what I was going to do more than the other, but I realized while getting into it that that became really important.
Yeah. I think what is so powerful about your book is it's you're talking about these principles based on your experience. This is not fantasy. It's not fiction. It's based on things that you experience directly, indirectly, or in some other way. And you use the term common sense in one place, which is ironic because, as you may know, if you flip through the pages of my book, one of the things I talked about in the third part of my book was the phrase common sense is just not that common. And they're probably, as you flip through it, you probably saw, I like that. That phrase makes sense. I like that. We could use that. And again, because I think there's, I think we have, you know, we if I wanted to be promotional on both our behalves, I would say that we should do a bundle deal with both our books. And get them into the hands of people. And I think the thing that we have in common again is a focus on experience and on people. Now your experience is much richer than my experience because you came into the trades. I've been in the industry for over 40 years, but I've been on the management side. I've been in the field. I've project managed work. I've run companies. I've done a variety of different things, as anybody can see in my LinkedIn profile. But you came in the trades door. Which now, as we sit here having this conversation, is a door that's wide open, but nobody's walking through it, and we'll talk about that as well. But you know, I think that the things that are important to me are four words: love, inclusion, social justice, and then leadership. Leadership is such a broad term in many ways, but also is very specific in the sense of the fact that it doesn't describe a position, a role, a responsibility. It's about an individual's words and actions and how they benefit by motivating and potentially inspiring the people that they lead. Right. You talk about love what you do, or at least like it. I like that second phrase because as a practical matter, you know, I can talk about what love is all about. I echo the principles of my mentor, a guy named Steve Farber, who wrote a book. His first book was, I guess, 21 years ago. And in that book, he had a set of phrases which I think about or say out loud almost every day. And so here it is for today. Do what you love in the service of people who love what you do. Now, exactly. That's, I mean, you can, if you don't agree with that, then this conversation is over.
Right.
But I know you do. And because you're talking about right there in your fifth principle, love what you do. And the practical matter every day is not going to be, you're not going to have this wonderful feeling because it could be something as simple as dealing with an individual who is a difficult personality for you to deal with, not because they're bad or good, but because your personalities are different.
Right.
What are you thinking about right now based on what I said?
Yeah. So I think the whole love what you do, or like it a lot, is I always tell people that we spend so much time and work in our career paths, and whether we're trying to figure it out, or we're deeply entrenched in it, we're doing it every day. We're commuting, we devote a lot of our energy and life to just how we provide for ourselves and our families. And if we don't take the time just to step back and consider what it is we actually want to do with our time, what we're going to do more than anything else in our lives, in addition to, you know, sleeping, it's really important that we think about those things as we choose something. And it can't just because what mom or dad wants you to do. It's got to be something that you have passion around. And I don't think a lot of people really consider that. I'm not sure if parents are adding that to the conversation when you're talking about what it is you want to do with the rest of your life, and I want you to go to this college or whatever it may be. Are we connecting passion and what keeps you up, what motivates you, along with a skill set that you have? It's so important that we include that in the conversation in regards to choosing a career. So I don't take it lightly. I think it's something that can sound like kind of cliche-ish, you know, with loving what you do. But when we look at statistics, we know that there's more than 50% of the people who work every day don't enjoy their jobs. And so those folks did not take the time, right? And sometimes we're forced just to go to work. So when I get a chance to talk to young people especially, or if you're trying for the second time or the third time about what I want to do with the rest of my life, it's, are you considering something that you enjoy? Mm-hmm. And if you're not doing that, you're most likely going to find something that you don't enjoy, and you're going to do it a long time. You're not going to get really good at it, and you might not find yourself being promoted or considered for you know, better opportunities because you just show up to get your job done. Mm-hmm. You're not involved in the how to connect the dots and build something and see yourself integrally involved in how it gets built. You're just doing a job. You're living for the weekend. And that's what a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. And I hate that term because it's such a short life. It's all I'm doing is Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then I hate Monday morning.
Yeah.
Don't want to do that.
Take me back to when you were making decisions or thinking about what you were going to do. Your initial thought was that you were going to get through high school, go to college, get an engineering degree, and then pursue a career in engineering. And then suddenly you're working at, I forgot what retail store you were working at Macy's, one of my favorite stores, especially when they have sales.
Yeah.
So here you are, you're working in a retail store. Your father had an entire career in the sheet metal trade?
Not an entire career. My dad bounced around a little bit, and he got into the trades later in life. But he was always working. And that was the thing that I saw my dad do, whether it's one or two jobs at times. He was always working. He was very industrious. That's not something I ever see him doing, sitting at home and not this idle time thing. He was always trying to provide for our family. And then he landed in the trades and in the sheet metal trade. And that's where he's spent his time until he retired. And so I got to see that. So that was also a very impactful, seeing your dad go to work every day and really showing and, advocating for, working hard and enjoying it. Now, will I say he loved his job? Maybe like I love my job? Probably not. I know he enjoyed it, but I know that what I got to do was take what he did and took it to a different level, but it wouldn't have happened if it weren't for just his ability to showcase that, to give me some instructions, verbally, as well as just actually showing me by demonstration, the importance of going to work and learning the trade and using your hands. He always showed me all kind of things around the house and working on cars and working in the yard and stuff I didn't like back then when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. But
I learned how important it was, and lots of my friends that were my age didn't have the skill to change their oil or change their brakes or give their car a tune-up, and those are the things that I really learned to appreciate as I got older.
Yeah. Yeah, well, in part, the difference between your father's outlook on his job and yours is generational. I'm a baby boomer on tipping the end of the scale, so to speak, and if I were to be totally truthful, I could easily say that as I look back at my early career and what I did for a paycheck, I didn't love it. I didn't love it at all. In fact, if I think back a little further, if I had had the opportunity to be to have someone say something or some things to me to get me to change paths and suddenly go from working in a retail store to getting involved with a trade, I don't know how I would have taken that, but I didn't. The opportunity was never presented, and although in high school. Something which disappeared. So high school is the early and mid 70s for me.
Yeah.
Probably before you were born. That's annoying, but that's okay. It's fine. I don't mind that you were born after me. It's not going to be a problem in our relationship.
Yeah.
We had auto shop, we had welding shop, we had plumbing, we had two or three other. I think wood shop, and they were all there and available. And at that time, the students that went through those programs were what we called in the early 70s greasers. They were the nefarious characters, and they'd rather be there than sitting in a classroom with a book and a pen or a pencil. But nonetheless, it was there. And then it disappeared in many, many educational systems across the country. And it really hasn't reappeared in a way that's helping us at all as an industry. I want to talk to you again about the whole notion of getting people into our industry. When I think about the word inclusion, I think about it in my broader context is that that inclusion recognizes the fact that that every person is different, but they all can and should have an opportunity to be in the game.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. And I think, does that say it reasonably?
Yeah, no, I think that is simply stated and aligns with what I believe as far as the definition. And I would say, you know, we are definitely behind the curve in regards to recruitment and how we advocate and really change the narrative of what it means to be a construction professional, what I like to call it. It's like you said, the trades that are the different classes in school that just don't exist anymore. And they are coming back, but not to the degree where you have this wave. It's still very sparse in getting people to get into the trades or get into classes that help them just be introduced to working with your hands. And then that notion that it's, you know, it's the greasers, it's the folks that nefarious folks, or the folks who may not necessarily be considered the ones that are, you know, got the clean cut look and maybe allegedly not as smart as the other person, you know, and so they got to take this path. And that's the part that saddens me in regards to going down the path of construction, because you think it's for the folks who can't, and you underline it with this myth that says this person's not smart enough, so you have to go into the trades. And just lower the bar, right? And so why do you think anyone would want to join something that doesn't require good judgment, common sense, smarts, when we know that it requires all those things and more? But the message has been it's for the folks who can't go to college. It's little Johnny is not smart as little Sarah. And so you got to go down this path, you know? And so you consider coming into the door kind of second class. And so as we're trying to bring people in, we've got to change the message and bring that esteem that it deserves going down this path. I can go to a college and get a four-year degree and go do X, or I can choose to go down the path of construction and do X. And they both have prestige. They both are going to provide me with a living and provide for my family and give me a sense of accomplishment in my life. And we shouldn't shun one or the other.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you know, at least by reputation, maybe you've even encountered him or seen him speak, Mark Breslin, who is very visible in our industry. You know, one of the things he says with a great degree of firmness and insistence, and that is that just if you're a carpenter or a plumber or a sheet metal worker, you are a professional. And you know, period, hard stop. And I absolutely agree with that, and I'm sure you do as well. I had on as a guest probably 7 or 8 months ago a gentleman by the name of Sean Strickland, who's the director of the Canadian Building Trades Union, which is comes under the North America Building Trades Union that Sean McGarvey runs, and his thought was we need to be telling a different story about the construction industry, and we also have to get it to the right audiences. If it's not simply attracting individuals to the industry, what, as it relates to manpower and resources, what do you think is the biggest problem right now that we're facing as an industry?
In regards to bringing people in?
People.
Yeah, I think it's we have allowed poor behavior to exist in this industry. It's part of the DNA. It's that you have to be a tough guy. You had to be this hard-nosed person. That's how you survived. If you weren't loud and mean and strong-willed, and some of that is not all bad. Being strong-willed is not a bad thing, but it's associated with a negative behavior. That's how you survive. And it's just the person that if you show a construction worker, it's just somebody that is just has this look of being mean and tough and strong and isolated, you know, and cigarette in their mouth, whatever, and just somebody who's not approachable. You got to have that veneer in order to make it. And so how does that encourage anyone that doesn't look like that, doesn't necessarily align with that kind of, you know, personality or appearance? They don't think they belong there, you know? And so I think it's created this problem of just keeping people out without even having to tell them that they don't belong, you know? And so it's just an image that we've created, and we have kind of licensed bad behavior. That's what I tell people, that it's just what we've done as an industry. And somehow, because we were the folks that, again, we weren't the clean shaving folks and clean cut and all that. And so we were kind of excused to do things that others wouldn't do in their career. They would be fired for in a heartbeat, you know? And so how did that happen? And it was perpetuated by what we've allowed. And so again, we're playing catch up to try to clean it up and make it a more welcoming environment for anyone that wants to enter the industry that we desperately need. Mm-hmm. And so I think that image is that the construction industry has is one of the biggest issues. And it's been kind of self-perpetuated. And I believe we're trying, lots of folks like yourself and are trying to help change that image and train folks who are leading of, hey, we can do more in a better way. And, you know, we don't have to fall prey to that image anymore. We can still be tough, but what does it look like? You know, and understanding that how suicide has played such a huge role, unfortunately, within our industry. And why does that exist? You know, and we pull those layers back and understand that whole veneer thing doesn't work. It's broken. Mm-hmm. And so we have to really look at it for what it is and figure out how do we change that?
Yeah. I'm going to be doing a special edition of my podcast in front of an audience of contractors and union folks from the finishing trades, the IUPAT. And the discussion we're going to have is going to be talking about women in the construction industry. There are two demographic groups that are not receiving equal treatment, I would say, that where they're not being given justice in as far as opportunity. One are women, and the others are black workers, both men and women. Right. Probably two of the most harmed categories of individuals available for our workforce that are looking for, some of them are looking for other opportunities. Some of them have the perception that you described very well, that this is not a welcoming place. They don't want me there. That's certainly the way most women feel. And I talk with a great deal of energy around just kind of the simple fact that, you know, if you look at the numbers, just over half of the population are female. And a whopping 3 or 4% females are in the construction workforce, and the numbers again on a race basis for white versus black versus yellow, if you want to use, or brown, those numbers are horrendous as well. There's just so much that needs to be done, and again, I know you talk about DEI and these issues quite a bit. Are you seeing any kind? And I'm asking because someone indicated that they've been getting a sense that there's some kind of pushing back on DEI. We've talked about it. But in my view, and your view is more important. My view, nothing's happened in relative terms. What do you think?
Yeah, as far as the pushing back, yeah, there's definitely a wave of that happening, and it has a lot to do with politics and where we are as a country. And then sometimes it does sound like old hat to people. And I had an opportunity just a couple weeks ago to speak with a large general contractor and about culture and specifically about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it was a room full, probably, well, I'll say it was like 95%. White men,
and the really, rest, what a surprise!
And the rest were women, you know, white women in the room, you know. And then there was me talking about DEI, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very interesting conversation. But one thing that I'll say, and they were a great representation of this, is this was something from their leadership that is the training that they put on for their field leaders. And I was very impressed with the intention that they put on the content and the folks that they tried to bring in the room to have these conversations that can be very uncomfortable. Someone that can relate to those folks who work in the field and not someone necessarily just from academia who can't identify with some of the nuances of what it means to be out in the field and working and how it's different than working in an office, you know. And so it was encouraging for me to see that, but also know and experience it, but also know that there is some pushback. And I think a lot of it has to do with just us not understanding what we're trying to accomplish, you know. And so what I did was there was no reason for me to make it a black and white conversation when I went in that room, because it was really not about that type of diversity. It was more about diversity of thought, being open minded about anybody in the room. Do they have a chance to interject and share an idea? Do they feel they are empowered to do that, or should they just go shut up and get their job done? You know, so they're trying to address that. You know, so there's so many different levels of complexity when it comes to this conversation. But if we only isolate it to one thing, then we're going to turn people off. And we have to be skillful in how we have these conversations. It's like the strategy has to have. You have to have a strategy of how am I going to address this issue where I can be impactful. I want people will listen to me, and they'll be willing to make some adjustments in their own personal lives, as well as how they perform on a job site every day. You know, so you gotta understand that. Otherwise, they see you coming in the door, and they're just gonna put their shield up, whether they're smiling in your face or not. They're gonna put their shield up and sit there and just go numb and say, "When are you gonna be gone so I can go back to doing what I already do?"
Right.
So there's a strategy behind it. There's a lot of resistance for sure. And again, a lot of it has to do with just ignorance. We just don't understand what are we really trying to do. And I try to look at it like this. If you're playing as a kid, you play a sport at recess, and you're the person getting picked on a team. You know, you line up against the wall. You want Mike. You want Johnny. You want Sarah. You know, and when you're the last person getting picked, or you're looking around, or you're not getting picked, you know, there you go with about the whole inclusion or belonging feeling. You automatically know what that feels like and know what it looks like. And so that's kind of like making it as simple as we can for people to understand. And in that room of, say, 500, or this one was 250 people, and they're all across the country, so not everybody knew each other. So I could say, all you guys look alike, you probably know each other, but I know that wasn't true. So I said, what if I ask you to move and sit beside somebody you don't know? Then there's a sense of, oh, that table all of a sudden of 10 feels a little bit different than I know all the my buddies here at the table. It's easy to have a casual conversation or a joke, but suddenly I have somebody that looks like me still, but I don't know them. That relationship is different. Mm-hmm. And so I feel a little bit awkward. I might feel a little bit uncomfortable. And so you try to get people to identify with what it may feel and look like when we're talking about these different issues that can make you uncomfortable. And so it's very complex, you know, and I think we don't all come from the same place. We don't have all the same experiences or opportunities. And we're just trying to get people to understand that. And the best way we do that is help them identify with themselves. And sometimes that's hard, but that's how we have to get it.
Yeah, no, well said. I think that one of the things that I say to groups all the time is I pose the simple question. It's semi-rhetorical, but it does kind of get at it. And the question is, what is one thing that you have in common with all the other 249 people in this room? And the answer is that you're different from each other. You know, so commonality is about differences.
Yeah.
If we could grab onto that a little bit more, and say we haven't used the B word yet, bias. We haven't used that word, but we're talking. That's really what we're talking about. Is because that if you had to point to something as the condition, it's implicit bias.
Yeah.
And again, the sad truth in most regards is that, you know, we are, as we sit here today having this conversation, we are who we are today. In terms of what we believe, what we think, what we know, all those elements is a result of everything we've experienced, things we heard our parents talking about in the kitchen, things we heard on the street, things we heard at work, things that we learned, things that we saw. It all affects the wiring of this control center that we call the brain. If you've got some bad wiring in there that got put into your system unbeknownst to you, suddenly you have a view about something which is not founded in reality, but it's the view you have. And that's why, and I get the sense that you have the same feeling. That's why I think it's so important to keep talking about these things.
Yes.
Even to push through the discomfort. And for me, you know, I'm in a special place, you know, because I am the old white guy. But I don't have a lick of discernible bias in me, but it's all been learned. because I've learned things just in the last 20 years of my life that make me a different and a better person than I was 20 years ago. And I think if anybody has the opportunity to keep an open mind to say that who you are is not fixed at a point in time. All you have to do is recognize that I need to learn or unlearn some things. I need to hear or unhear some things, and let them impact me. And all I have to do is have the desire to change.
Yeah, that is so true, and it's about that awareness or self-awareness. You know, and realizing that I love to tell people when we did some of our training that we've done here in Southland regarding just the DEI work and having those conversations was I acknowledge first, this is uncomfortable, no question, but we're going to do it. And what I want to set up is the ground rules. And the ground rules are, I want you to be able to say whatever it is you need to say in a respectful way. That's all I ask, is that let's have these hard conversations. You want to ask me, why does this matter? Why does it feel like this for me? And being able to say that and creating a safe place for everyone, even the white guy, mm-hmm. you got to be able to say what's on your mind and be able to ask a question. All I say is that do it with respect. Don't purposely try to offend someone or say things that you know are going to be offensive. Think about how you can articulate your thought, but absolutely share your thought. Because if you walk away with someone talking who you think is just a victim, and all they're doing is saying how you're treating me poorly, then you're gonna probably be felt stronger in your position than you did when you came to the room. So we want you to be able to ask a question and say, what's on your mind and what is their resistance? But you don't get that. You won't get that real talk unless you create the safe environment. You know, and I've seen that happen where it's been very effective, where you get a chance to get people to say, what really bothers me when I hear these words, DEI and belonging? And, you know, you've probably heard this when, like, we use the word soft in construction and you got, you know, these strong profile. I don't want to use the word soft. You know, that's not what we do and all this stuff. But it makes you feel uncomfortable because you don't understand it, you know, but you want to be able to ask questions so that you can gain some understanding and maybe see where you fit in the scheme of perpetuating bad behavior or how you can become more of an advocate for what can help people get better.
Yeah. You know, and we're getting close to at the end of our time, which means two things. Number one, we didn't have enough time. But number two, it also means that sometime in the next few months, you're coming back so we can have a very specific session to talk through each one of the seven principles. We've touched on several of them just in the course of our conversation, and I think this conversation is one that people will listen to with some degree of enthusiasm. We share some common beliefs. We share some common understanding of the hurdles that face our industry. I can see now that I've had this chance to have a conversation with you why you're so highly regarded. It's not just your book. So you got a book. All right, you got a book. I think I beat you with the number of pages. You know, and I say that not in all seriousness, but for me, I'm curious. For me, I never thought I was going to write a book somewhere in my career. It was not in my mind. Yeah. And the idea of going through the process of writing a book was something I never thought I'd be able to do. Just because in the DISC profiling system, I'm a high I, and you've got a lot of I in you if you're not simply an I in that DISC profiling system.
Yes.
But to sit in front of a computer and put an outline together, and I just never thought I could do it.
Yeah.
But I did.
Yeah.
And as did you. And we kept it within our reach. You
know, exactly.
I loved your book because I liked this, and I also liked the size of the type font on the pages.
Now, I know who my readers are going to be.
Well, you know, again, this is a book, in fact, because I did it the first time when I first got it back in October when I bought it. And I took it on a flight with me, a long flight, and I finished it on the plane.
Yeah.
And it's also the way you're talking with people in this book. It's not an educational program. It's not technical in nature. You're talking to them. And so I compliment you on doing something that's important and valuable and needs to be part of the framework of how this dialogue that you and I are both trying to carry on in our industry needs to continue. This has been a joy for me, Henry, and I appreciate you coming on the show, and you will be coming back at some point in time. I'll let you get over this because I'm a little bit too much. I understand that.
You know? No, this is great. Dennis, thank you so much for having me here. It's like you said, this is a great conversation. It's one that will continue with me amongst other guests you have, and keep doing what you're doing, you know, and we all need to be in there channeling for this new wave that we need to get people inspired and understand how important this conversation is and help change our industry.
Thanks, Henry.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today for this episode of the Softest Steel Podcast with your host, Dennis Duran. Dennis is the author of Softest Steel and a leading speaker and trainer for organizations across many industries and verticals. To learn more about the work Dennis is doing to activate soft skills in the workplace, contact him at DennisDuranSpeaking.com. Be sure to check out his book, Softest Steel, on Amazon or wherever books are sold. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you'd like to get your podcasts. And please remember to share this episode with your friends, colleagues, and anyone you feel would benefit from the conversation. We'll see you next time on the Softest Steel Podcast with Dennis Duran.
Produced by AutoVita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.